My name is Maria Hamlin Zuniga. I was born in Minnesota, and I live in Central America. I'm saying that for the tape, okay?
Yes.
I'd like to know a little bit about you people. Where are you all from? We're such a small group. Could we introduce ourselves?
Yeah. I'm Jerry Olstead. I'm from Chicago.
I'm Alan Kirch. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I'm Margaret Madelmacki from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which is 180 miles north of Minneapolis.
Lois Brew from Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Joanne Anderson from Auburn, California.
Carol Balti from Los Angeles.
Barbara Hart from Northwest Oregon at present.
I'm Gary Rose from Salisbury, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. I'm Judy Hart. I'm from Renton, Washington.
Gary Hart from Renton, Washington.
Well, it's nice to see some of you back and to see some new faces too. You probably have no idea what's going to be talked about here today. So what I want to do is explain to you a little bit about why I'm here and what I'd like to do today. Because today I want to try to meet some of the expectations of some of the people who have come to other sessions. The topic that I've been working on this week is related to the conquest of the Americas, no? The discovery, maybe not the discovery of, as we think of it in our schools and how we've been taught in the past, but discovering much more about what really happened here in the Americas and what was here before. And so with Cindy, I have been trying to do a series speaking not from the mouth of the white people who came, but trying to represent a bit the thoughts, the feelings, and the life of the Indian people who lived here in the Americas long before Columbus and other people thought of coming here. And so what we did in the first session was try to review very quickly what happened at the time of Columbus's coming. I'm not going to go into that again. On the wall over there are descriptions of what discovery or conquest meant to the people who lived on these lands. When we talk about America, what do you think of? Anybody?
North Central South.
Mm-hmm.
Geographic place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just a great country.
You think of this country.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think of this country. Usually.
Uh-huh.
I think you sort of think of your own country first, and then you have a corrective that's that opportunity mm-hmm. that says, but there's more to America than the U.S.
Yes. There is more to America than the U.S. But for some reason, we who are U.S. citizens speak of our country as America. But one of the things that we have been trying to do during this last week is help people to come to an understanding of what are the Americas. And the Americas are much greater than just the United States. They're much greater than what most U.S. citizens think of when they speak of America. Americans are people from Central America, people from Canada, Alaska, people from Tierra del Fuego, at the very tip of South America. All of the people who live on these continents of North and South America are Americans. I want to meet the expectations of some people who were in other sessions when I asked, what are your expectations? Because people ask me to explain a little bit about my story. So if you will pardon me and bear with me, I will share a little bit about who I am and where I came from. Maybe where I'm going. There are some popular verses from Columbia that I want to read. It says, I don't know who I am, nor just where I was bedded. Don't know where I'm from, nor where the hell I'm headed. I'm a piece of fallen tree. Where it fell, I do not know. Where can my roots be? On what sort of tree did I grow? Most of you were born in the United States, right? All of you were born in the United States. We don't think of why we are born where we're born, do we? And maybe a lot of us don't ever think about it at all until someone questions us or questions who we are. A number of years ago, I had to think about who I was and why I was the way I was, or why I am the way I am. I was born in Minnesota, like a lot of you. I didn't choose to be born there. None of us choose to be born where we're born, or to choose our parents or where they came from. And so I think we by accident come to be in the places where we are, by accident and by God's will, because I believe in God. So I was born there and I was raised there by my parents, who had their origins, my father in the early United States, and my mother's family, my grandmother's family, in Ireland. Well, a few years ago I went to Ireland and I discovered a little bit about why I am the way I am. We'll get to that. So, I was born and brought up in a family that was an Irish Catholic family, although my father was not. He was a Congregationalist. So I had these traditions.
Where in Ireland did they live?
The grandmother's family?
Yeah.
In County Cork.
Oh, my, that's wonderful.
We're Corcorans and Fogartys. So I was brought up in Minnesota. I was brought up in a Catholic home. And from the time that I was a very young girl, I wanted to be a religious worker. And when I was 13, I was convinced that I was called to go to the convent. Like lots of little Catholic girls, I wanted to be holy and chaste and all of those things that we're taught to be, right?
Yeah.
And so I told my father I wanted to go to the convent. Well, I told him this after I had been out riding my bicycle and fooling around and playing baseball, right? And he said, I don't think you're ready to go to the convent yet. And I went away to the woods and I cried. And I cried for a long time and I thought, well, you know, maybe he's right. I'll go to high school here. And so I went through my high school years wanting to be a doctor. I wanted to go to a convent and be a doctor too, right? So I kept wanting to be a doctor. And in my Girl Scout troop, we were able to go and be workers in Minneapolis General Hospital, volunteer workers, and I worked in the laboratory with the medical technicians. And after I finish doing my badge, any of you Girl Scouts?
Sure.
Of course. After I did my badge, I stayed. I was like 15 years old. And from the time I was 15 years old until I was almost done with college, I worked in Minneapolis General Hospital. I wanted to be a doctor, and there were doctors there who were sympathetic with me, and so they started helping me to learn all sorts of things. So before I graduated from high school, I was working in the autopsy room. Now that seems a strange sort of thing to want to do, doesn't it? But the most important part of learning to be a doctor is understanding the human body. And I was learning the physiology in the laboratories, and I had to learn the anatomy. What I want to say is that I was very young, and I was very fortunate to have people who would sort of break the rules and teach me and let me grow in that way of understanding the medical work, the medical profession, understanding a lot of things that I didn't like about medicine too, kinds of things that were going on. And because every day I had to go out and chart the results, I mean, we didn't have computers, right? I'm talking about 1954, 55. I'm 51 years old. So I would go out and chart every evening the results from the laboratory. And that way I got to know the patients. And I saw that many of the patients who were poor or indigent patients were beautiful people, people who had stories. And they were willing to share their stories. Some of them were old people. Most of them were poor. Some of them were Indian people. And those were the really poor. And so I began to ask a lot of questions about why does this poverty exist? Why in a country and in a state and in a city that had so much richness about it were there these people who had no home or had lost their family or somehow had lost their rootedness? And I still felt called to be a religious person. But I was also called to many other things. I had all of these wonderful disciplines that I was interested in. And another friend and I, when we began to study in the university, instead of taking a major, decided we wanted to take what is called an interdepartmental major. And that way, I was able to combine the natural sciences that were required for studying pre-med with social sciences, with anthropology and sociology, and with the humanities, with literature and art. And in all this, I kept singing because I was also a singer. And so I went through those years, and one of my good friends was the dean of the medical school. He was my friend because I took care of his babies. I babysat. And he kept saying to me, no, no, you can't be a doctor. You know, I've been hearing this all the time. I was in Minneapolis General because women weren't doctors. Women were other things like nurses or technicians or teachers, but they weren't doctors. And that was really true, because at the time that I was in the University of Minnesota in my pre-med work, there was a quota, and only 7 women could go to a school of 100 students. This seems strange now, doesn't it? But that's the way it was, and that was Minnesota, a progressive state. Well, in any case, I kept saying, no, I'm going to be a doctor. What's wrong with learning all these other things? I want to be a missionary too. Well, there was this program at the University of Minnesota for foreign students. And we had brothers and sisters who were foreign students, and we would be their brothers and sisters when they would come and get to know them and do things with them. And another person who was with me in student government at the university said, you know, we have foreign students here, right in our city, and they're American Indians. Why don't we start a program for the American Indians? Because they were foreign among us. No? They were the people of this land, and yet they were foreigners in our midst, because they didn't know how to get along in the university any better than somebody who came from Pakistan or China. And so we started a program of being brothers and sisters to American Indians in our university. And so I came to know and to love dearly the Indian people with whom I was being a brother and sister to. Well, later on, when I was going between my junior and senior year, I decided I wanted to do a study project. But I didn't want to do what everybody else was doing. Everybody else was going to go over to Europe and do their study. And I said I wanted to go somewhere else. And so I chose to go somewhere with the World Health Organization. And I went to Washington to speak to the director of the World Health Organization for the region of the Americas. And I explained what I wanted to do, and he sort of looked at me. Well, it was hard to get into his office, you know. He was a very important man, but I was determined I was going to talk to him. So I said I wanted to go to Southeast Asia. Well, he was very encouraging. And I'm thankful for him and for other people who came into my life at that time. He said, yes, we'll help you to go to Southeast Asia. What I wanted to do was try to discover how the programs that are set out in the United Nations filter down to the local level, if they did. So I went back to the University of Minnesota, and I had to have an advisor for my project. So Dr. Gaylord Anderson, who was the dean of the School of Public Health, became my advisor. And I went off to Southeast Asia. The year was 1960. And I spent time in the Philippines, in Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and also in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Japan. I was gone 4 months, and I came back, and I began to write and to speak about what had happened to me. Because I found out that medical professionals, like I wanted to be, were caught up always curing people, always taking care of the same kinds of diseases, and never seeing any change. Every morning, the doctors and the nurses would have people lined up at their clinic doors. And somehow, the line never stopped. And that experience gave me the opportunity to analyze what were the causes of illness and what were the causes of disease in the communities. And I had the good fortune of spending some time with some people who were health educators, who were trying to change people's attitudes and bring about changes in practices. And so I really got interested in this other kind of work in preventive medicine. And when I went back to the university and talked to my advisor, he said, I don't think you should be a doctor. I think you should be a public health worker. What I will do is in this, your last year of the university, I'll let you take some public health courses and see if you don't like it. Finish up your other classes, but come to the core course in the School of Public Health. And this was at a time when to go to the School of Public Health, you had to have between 3 and 5 years of professional work in public health. But another door was open for me. And the door was that of learning about public health before I had to make the choice. I said I went in 1960. In 1960, when I came back and talked about what was happening in Vietnam, because it was just beginning, I was there shortly after a plan had been made to assassinate, what was his name? Well, it slips my mind now, but the president of the country at the time. And I started saying, you know, something's going to happen in Vietnam. And people didn't know where Vietnam was, of course, in 1960. Well, when it came time to make the decision whether I would go to medical school or the School of Public Health, I had to make that decision because I was accepted to medical school. And 2 weeks before medical school began, I decided to go to the School of Public Health, to go through that door that Gaylord Anderson opened for me. And of course, all of my friends thought I had lost my mind. And my parents did too. Because from the time I was 10, I wanted to be a doctor. And now I wanted to be a public health worker. There's not much status in that. Well, there isn't. But that's not what I was looking for. I was looking for a way to make a difference, to find some way so that people wouldn't have to be coming back sick and having the doctor all the time. So I made the decision to go to the School of Public Health, but with one condition, that I could do my field work with the Indians. I didn't care where they would be, but just they had to be Indians. And so I did. I went to the Southwest, to the Pueblo Indians. And I learned, by living with them for those 9 months, I learned many of the stories of their origins, and I learned to love and live with another people who, through the time that I was there, because I was a young person, I was able to get to know many other young Indian people. There, they had been going to the university for some time. And so I had contact with the Indians in the University of New Mexico, and I, of course, was working with them on a daily basis in health education. And I was convinced that somewhere in that, in the roots of my being, there must have been some Native American people, because I felt that I was coming home to something. Well, when I finished my field work and finished my master's degree, I wrote my thesis on migrant workers, and I wrote on how one could do health education through community organization. And so I was hired through the Migrant Health Act of 1963 to work with migrant workers, and that was the first time that the federal government gave funding for health education for migrant workers. Are you beginning to see the pattern? Mm-hmm. I like to be a pioneer. So, while I was working with migrant workers, I discovered more things about myself. I discovered how fortunate I had been to have lived in Minnesota in a state with a democratic farm labor background, and that I had not learned to hate people in my home, in my family, in my schooling. And I went to Texas. I went to West Texas. And suddenly, because I was working with migrant workers who were Spanish-speaking, today you call them Hispanic people, we called them Chicanos, you know, at that time. Because I worked with those people, the white people in the city where I was living, which was Lubbock, Texas, would look upon me as not quite right. It was not the correct thing to do, to work with those Mexicans. You could be in the migrant ministry and go out and do something for those poor people in the camps, but you couldn't be organizing those people to make changes in those camps. Well, that's what I was doing. I was a troublemaker. I was working for the city, county health department, and later I worked for the state health department. And people would say to me, well, your job is health education. Your job isn't community organization, but that's what I was all about, community organization and health education. And so if the only way to resolve the problems of community people is by organizing those people, why is that wrong? Well, you're not supposed to do that. You're a troublemaker. Well, that's probably true. Why shouldn't I be a troublemaker if what I want to do is work with people for their rights and for the rights of their children? But people will say to me, but they're Mexicans. Well, so they're Mexicans. They are human beings. Well, I learned a lot in Texas. I learned a lot in Texas that I never learned as a young woman in Minnesota. Now, maybe that's not true anymore. That could be different now for people because of the spread of Hispanic people throughout the United States. And maybe today there's more prejudice in the state of Minnesota than there was when I grew up. But among my friends and in my family, we weren't taught to distinguish people by their colors. Well, while I was in Texas, I was asked to train a group of Peace Corps volunteers. Now, the Peace Corps began because of people like Humphrey, who was from Minnesota, who thought young people should go abroad and learn about people in other countries, but also take that enthusiasm of youth and have people learn about Americans, U.S. Americans, in other parts of the world. And I trained Peace Corps volunteers who went then to Latin America. And so I began to make the connection between the work that I was doing with Spanish-speaking people and my relationships with Indian people that had continued, and discovering for myself Latin America, beyond Mexico, all the way to the Andean countries. And there came a time when the Peace Corps recruited me. And I said, okay, I'll do this. I'll try a new field. I'll go a little bit farther south. And so in 1968, I was assigned to go to the Andean countries. But I hadn't finished my work yet in Texas. I had 2 more months to go, and a call came from Washington, from the Peace Corps. And they said, we would like you to go to Nicaragua to set up the first Peace Corps program. And I said, Nicaragua? But isn't Nicaragua a dictatorship? I had read about Central America and about Latin America because I was going to go there and I wanted to prepare myself. And they said, well, it has been reclassified. Uh-huh. So what is it now? It's a limited democracy.
Limited to one.
Okay, well,
yeah.
I said, I'll do it for 2 reasons. I wanted to be one of the first to do it. And I wanted to find out what was really going on in Central America. And this would be a way that I could do it. The other reason is that the reason I accepted to go was because I was the first woman to be given a staff position as associate director of the Peace Corps in Latin America. Because women weren't given those positions because of the machismo that exists in Latin America. So they always felt that no woman could be a director because only men could be directors. Does this sound familiar to some of you?
Yes.
So here I am again faced with that dilemma that I had faced as a young girl wanting to be a doctor. Now I was going to be a director, and that wasn't quite the thing for a woman to do. Well, in any case, I went, and what happened? It was 1968. Well, back in Texas, I had been active in registering people to vote, and I was for McCarthy, of course. And so what happened was Nixon was elected. And while the previous administration had a policy in the Peace Corps that there would be no people working in the Peace Corps that had any connection with agencies that were law or drug agencies, and that the Peace Corps would not have a political ideology. How can this be? But I mean, this is the kind of thing they would say, right? That the Peace Corps would not be mixed up in U.S. foreign policy. Nixon became the president, and the Peace Corps immediately became a part of U.S. foreign policy in a very overt way. When people ask me about this, I have to be very honest, because what happened is, as the Peace Corps director, associate director, I would sit on the country team. The country team are the people in the embassy who are the heads of departments. If the Peace Corps was not a part of U.S. foreign policy, what were we doing on that country team? And as a member of the country team, I got to know the other individuals who were the heads of the departments and what they were saying, what they were planning, and what they expected of us. And what they expected of us is that we would report to them any kinds of activities that were going on in the communities that we were setting up for Peace Corps volunteers that might be interesting for U.S. purposes. Now, I'm in a country that has a huge, huge history of U.S. intervention from very early on. But we were told very clearly that those Sandinistas, this guerrilla movement that had sprung up in the 60s, had been totally eliminated. Well, something didn't fit. I started working with the volunteers who were coming in, the first Peace Corps volunteers in Nicaragua, and we were setting up their sites and giving them their training. And in that training, I began to work with students and faculty from the Central American University, a Jesuit university. And what we did is we took people out to the countryside and introduced them to people in the countryside and the traditions and the culture and so on. And I got to know a lot of these young university people quite well. And because they were more or less my age, that became my social group. That and the parish that I chose to belong to, which was the first basic Christian community in Nicaragua. The first community that grew out of the theology of liberation in that country. And so I was fortunate because I was based in a Christian community and I had exposure to people who were questioning what was happening in their country. And naturally, because I was in these two groups of Nicaraguans, I came to question what was happening to me and what was happening to the organization that I was working with, the Peace Corps. And the more I questioned it, the more trouble I got into. At one time, I was called into the embassy, and the political officer began to talk to me about my friends. And he asked me to be an informant. And he was the director of the CIA in Nicaragua. Now, I'm telling you this because you must know that these things happened. People will deny that Peace Corps people were agents of the U.S. government. But in Nicaragua,
I was asked to be an informant for the CIA, and I refused. And I not only refused, but I went to my friends and I told them. And I told them to be careful. And 20 years later, I found out why my friends were important to the US government. It took me 20 years to find out. But that moment was a moment of awakening for me, and a moment in which I then had to reflect on my future and my decisions. When I finished my contract, because I wouldn't break it, and they wouldn't, I became a lay missioner. And I went to live among the Indian peoples of northeastern Nicaragua, the Miskito Indians. I went there as a health educator. I went there to live with the Catholic sisters and the Capuchin priests. And together we worked with the Moravians. Do any of you know who the Moravians mm-hmm. are?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're rather like Lutherans.
Yes.
They have the same origin.
Actually, they're older than.
Yeah.
They're pre-Luther Protestants.
Yeah.
And they Christianized the people of the Atlantic coast of Central America. And so they had schools and nursing schools and hospitals and high schools, grade schools and high schools, 100 years before anybody else was doing that sort of thing. And so together we formed a team, and we worked on the development of leadership on the Rio Coco, the river, the Coco River, which is the border between Honduras and Nicaragua. And during that time, we were working with housewives, homemakers, we were working with religious leaders, with agricultural workers, I was training health leaders, community-based health care in the community. Because there was no way that we who were working in the clinic or the hospital could possibly reach out to all those people. And so we developed a program whereby we prepared community people to do medical preventive work. And that was my work, organizing those communities around their health problems and looking for solutions within the communities for those problems. One of the priests I was working with was doing concientización, or building awareness among the Indians about their rights. And one of their rights was being able to read and write and study the constitution of the country. And we were working with the constitution, helping people who were illiterate come to understand the Constitution, because some of the people we were working with were judges, were local judges, and they would have to interpret that. And as a result of that work, it was stated that what we were teaching was subversive material. We were teaching the Constitution of the country. And that was reported to the National Guard, which was a very repressive force at the time in Nicaragua. And as a result of that kind of work and organizing communities and having communities come together, I'm talking about very small, scattered communities. There were 54 of them along 150 miles of river, small communities. The largest one were about 2,000 people. Because we were doing that, we were considered subversive. And one day I went for a year, and I ended up marrying there, and my two children, who you have seen around here, to me they're the most beautiful children here, of course. they are Miskito Indians. Their father's Miskito Indian. And I stayed, and I had all intentions of continuing to stay, but one day a plane was supposed to take me up the river, because at that time I was pregnant with my son. The plane was to take me up the river, and the plane didn't come. And I couldn't figure that out. And so I got a radio call, and my colleague who was working with me said, "You are casa por cárcel." That means I was under house arrest. But he was about 75 miles away from me, and he's telling me I'm under house arrest, and nobody had told me. So I thought, what's going on here? So then in the evening, a friend of mine came back from Puerto Cabezas, which was where the National Guard had their base, and he said, "You're under house arrest." And I said, "I don't understand." And he said, "Well, they're coming to tell you, but you're going to be kicked out of the country. You better figure out what you're going to do." So I got on the first plane that came in, and I went to the Minister of Health. I was the director of the health center. And I went to the minister and I said, "Okay, this is an Oxfam England project. It's ending at the end of this year, and I intend to finish it. And I want you to make sure nothing happens to me before the end of the year, and then I will go." He was able to keep them from kicking me out of the country, which actually meant just telling me to go across the river and get on my way, because I was on the border. So in 1975, I left Nicaragua. I left Nicaragua as persona non grata. If any of you have been in Jeremiah in the morning, we talked about people who go into exile. My home, my family, my people had become those people with whom I was working. "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." Those had been my vows in my marriage. And suddenly, I was an exiled person. Now, of course, I could come back here, right? But I went where my husband was studying to be a veterinarian. I went to Guatemala, and I began to train village-level health workers in Guatemala. Well, it didn't take very long to discover that, again, working with Indian people, helping Indian people discover their rights, discover that they too can make transformations in their lives, and learning from them, soon that also became subversive. Well, I don't think that what I was doing was wrong. And I couldn't understand for a long time why the things that I was doing, teaching people about health, helping people to make decisions about their own health, helping people to have a health system in their community because the government didn't provide any health system, I couldn't understand why that was wrong and why so many people thought it was wrong. It had been wrong to do it in Nicaragua, and now it was becoming wrong to do it in the Indian communities where I lived in Guatemala. In 1976, we had an earthquake in Guatemala, and it destroyed the highlands. It destroyed all of the adobe homes in the highlands. In the city, nothing fell down, but it broke open all those adobe homes, the highlands where the Indians live. And what it did is it broke open and made plain to everybody the injustice that exists in the world. Because why do Indian homes fall down and the homes of rich people in Guatemala not fall down? It's because of what they are made of and how they're made. And so what that earthquake did was not only open up the earth, break open the earth, but it broke open in the minds and the hearts of many people that which was unjust in their lives. It exposed to many, many people what was going on, the injustice in the system. And it was then that I began to understand even more fully what love meant. Love was not loving one person or a group of people, or talking about love in the sense that I love my neighbor. Love then became for me a struggle for social justice and a conversion. The earth broke open and opened up for me a new way of looking at what was happening. And then I guess I really did become a subversive person, right? Because when you start talking not about love for one another as neighbors, but love for humanity and a struggle for social justice, then people don't like you at all, because you start challenging the whole system in which we are living. And some of you know Joel Muggy, don't you, in the Center for Global Education? Some of you are here. Well, I was working in Guatemala, and Joel came to Guatemala in a group from the University of Minnesota, from the New World Institute. And that was one of his first exposures to Latin America. And it, his visit to Guatemala made him set up, caused him to decide to set up the Center for Global Education. You know? And that's how we met, and that's how we've continued our friendship over the years, and that's actually why I'm here in Holden Village today, because of Joel. Well, during the years that I lived in Guatemala, I saw many things. And I decided that not only did my work have to be in health, as a health educator, but to work for the health of many people in humanity who have health in the sense of a sound body and a sound mind, but who have, because of the way we have been brought up and the way we've been formed and taught, who have a sickness that oftentimes is not recognized. And that sickness for me is the injustice that exists in the world and that many of us are part of without knowing that. And so, in addition to working with people who were in the Indian communities, I had to, from that experience, speak out and help do an awareness among people who were the people from the country that was the cause of so much of that injustice. Now, I think it's really important that people don't take personally what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you are not just and loving and caring, because you are. But our system is not, and we're a part of that system. Our system is not loving and caring. Our system is the same as the system that Christopher Columbus lived in and worked for. A system that wants power and that wants wealth and will do anything to have it. Will kill and invade and destroy to have wealth and power. And we can see that in so many ways. Thing is, I've had to live on the other side. I have lived in invasion and genocide in Nicaragua. I've lived through invasion and genocide in Guatemala. And I've also worked in Salvador until I couldn't work there anymore because it was dangerous for me to go there. And all of my work and the work of others like me has been in health or in pastoral work, and because we do that work, we have become people who are dangerous and who are subversive. And some of those subversive people you have heard of. You never heard of me, but you've heard of the sisters who were killed in El Salvador. Well, one of those sisters and I were friends from the first week that I was in Nicaragua in 1968. Maura was my close friend. And Maura died, and priests died, and lay people were killed, and all because they were speaking out for social justice. And this has happened especially in Guatemala, in El Salvador, and in Nicaragua. And to bring it even closer to home, one of the people who was assassinated in Nicaragua during the counter-revolutionary war was a young man from Portland, Oregon. His name was Ben Linder. And Ben Linder was our friend, our close and dear friend. And he, just as these other people that I've mentioned, are the martyrs of our day. The other evening we were here in this room and we were talking about what may happen, what hope there is for the world in the next 500 years. Well, what is the hope for the world in the next few years? For most people, it was hard to think of 500 years. And I want to tell you something that was said by Monsignor Romero. You know who Monsignor Romero is, don't you? You all know who he is. He was a man, a very simple man, who was made bishop. And nobody ever dreamed that Monsignor Romero would be a radical man, because he was such a quiet, loving, not rippling the waters man. But people began, his parishioners began to die and his priests were being killed. And he said one time that he thought it would be a very sad thing that if so many people were being killed that a priest would not be killed. And he said that the seeds of liberation, the seeds of hope, come from the earth that is being fertilized, is being enriched by the blood of the martyrs of the Americas. And the hope came from all of this blood being shed. Now, for us, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing to hear of the martyrs of the Americas, no? It's a sad thing, perhaps, to know how many people have died in El Salvador or Guatemala or Nicaragua or Panama, in the invasion of Panama. But when most of us don't know people who have died. But when you know these people, when they're your friends, when they're your colleagues and co-workers, then it becomes very, very difficult to not cry out in anguish and despair. And to hear the words of Monsignor Romero that this is our liberation, then we go back to our Christian origins and examine and think about what Jesus said, that this blood is being shed for the love of us. And this blood of our brothers and sisters is also being shed so that we may be free. You know? And I think that is the hope of the Americas. So much blood has been shed. And so much blood has been shed because people want liberation. The Indians wanted liberation from the Spanish conquerors. The Spanish conquerors stayed here, became part of these nations of the Americas. Their blood is mixed. They are now one people. And their blood is being shed again for liberation. And we are all part of one people. To go back to what I said in the beginning, one does not know where their roots are. I think that it's so important to try to understand that we aren't just Norwegians or Irish or English or Dutch or whatever. We're part of these Americas. We're part of this land. We're part of these people. And we too need to cry out for our liberation. And in the case of you people who live here and work here and worship here and struggle here, I think the important thing that I want to say is just open up your eyes and discover the Americas. Discover who you are, what you are, and where you're going. And I'm grateful to the people of the Americas who've made me not a white person or an Irish person or an English person, but a part of this world, this new world, where we look for the liberation of all peoples so we all can be one people. Thank you. My husband separated from our family about 5 years ago. Our marriage was a victim of the war, of the war and the misunderstandings. And
yes. When will you, are you going to return to England?
Yes, I'm going back on the 29th of August.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I run a health education organization. That's another full discussion. But next week I'll get into that.
What are the major illnesses there? Are they tropical ulcers or tuberculosis or malaria?
We have the number one cause of death for children is diarrhea and upper respiratory infections. We don't have complicated diseases. People die before they get those. We do have malaria, but it's not a killing malaria. It's debilitating. We do have tuberculosis, and we have, that's basically.
Yeah.
We have cholera, but very little in Nicaragua compared to some of the other countries because of the health education that's been done over the last 10 years. People know what to do about
it. I have heard of fringes of bits from other Peace Corps people who ran against, who have interruption in their work. Not a specific issue, but apparently during that administration, they really clamped down on anybody that was whom they considered a spy or someone who was making trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Marie, have you given any thought to the Alaskan Indians?
Have I given any thought to them?
Have you had any time to do that or studied it at all?
Well, a little bit. When I studied anthropology way back then.
There is a wonderful book called Tisha, but it's about an Alaskan, a woman who went up there to teach.
That'd be great.
Oh, that's an absolute beautiful book. She experienced discrimination like crazy because she was defending the Indian. It's a wonderful book.
Well, when one makes an option for the poor, we have to suffer the same way the poor suffer. That's part of the option.
Wonderful to hear your story. Thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. It's a beautiful story.